Another special podcast right here on Sports Talk Chicago. My name's John Zaglul, and today we're welcoming in a very special guest to talk about the MLB Hall of Fame voting results, her take on the new MLB proposed rule changes, and of course, her amazing journalistic career. I'm really looking forward to today's show. Lots of in-depth conversations to come, and so glad that you're here joining us. Before we get started, make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports and hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram at John Zags, on Twitter at John Z Sports, and now on Facebook at John Zaglul. Today's show is brought to you by Moochie World, where inspiration meets creation. Call 708-247-2100 to book parties, paint your own pottery, and have art classes for adults and children. Moochie World, creativity at its finest. And by the Windy City Thunderbolts. Get ready for the team's 2019 season as they celebrate their 20th anniversary. Purchase tickets right now at 708-489-2255. Again, that's 708-489-2255 for your chance to be a part of history this summer in Crestwood. Well, as we get going here today, there are two main reasons why I'm specifically looking forward to this show. Number one, our guest today is a BBWAA member, and for the first time this past year, she received a Hall of Fame ballot. She voted for 10 people. She filled up her ballot and has repeatedly said that there were 13, even 16 people she can consider voting for in the future. So I'm looking forward to picking her brain a bit, understanding her reasoning and her logic behind voting for certain players and keeping certain ones off the ballot. And secondly, I want to get her thoughts on the new MLB proposed rule changes. I understand the fact that entertainment and pace of play are two big issues for the MLB, but the question is, will these new rule changes affect the game in a negative way? Look, say what you want, but baseball has stood the test of time. It's been around since the 1870s, and for the most part, the changes that have been enacted have not necessarily made the game better or worse off. But the question is, will these new changes that are being proposed and that could come into effect very soon, will those changes ruin the game that we all know and love? And that's a fundamental question that I plan on talking to my guest about here on today's show. So now that I've put some of these thoughts in your head, sit back and enjoy our conversation as we talk about everything Major League Baseball. It's now time for our special guest. She began her sports journalism career in 1996, co-founding BaseballProspectus.com, a publication devoted to the sabermetric analysis of baseball. By 2000, she became an acquisitions editor of Brassy Sports while contributing web-based content to Sports Illustrated and ESPN. Today, she's the senior MLB editor at ESPN and a member of the Baseball Writers Association of America. Please welcome Christina Carl to the show. Christina, how are you doing today, and thank you for being here on the show.
Well, I'm doing great since Pitchers and Catchers is just around the corner, and I can't thank you enough for the invitation.
Well, to start today, Christina, let's take a look back at the Baseball Hall of Fame results released a couple of weeks ago. Now, before we get to your ballot and who you voted for, what's your reaction to the four players who received induction this year, and do you think that they all deserve this honor?
Oh, absolutely. I think I can't be happier that Edgar Martinez finally got his due. It was, of course, his last year on the ballot, so the fact that he finally did get in and was acknowledged for, frankly, I think, you know, a franchise-changing performance in the course of his career, helping along with Ken Griffey Jr. to really kind of turn the entire Mariners franchise around, get them into the postseason for the first time, to finally recognize, like, what he was his value to that franchise, and essentially saving baseball in Seattle, because there was so much talk in the 90s of moving the team. He's a really important player. You can't, like, really talk about the 90s without also mentioning Edgar Martinez, and so I'm just delighted to see him finally get in. Mike Mussina, same case. He should have been in already. It was great to see, again, one of the great starting pitchers of his era finally get his due, and that's kind of a systemic problem for, I think, the Hall of Fame in general. It's just that starting pitchers are going to be hard, particularly like with modern-day tactics like the opener, like coming to the fore. It's going to be hard to see how starters have a path to the Hall of Fame if, you know, there are things chewing into their workloads. How are they going to accumulate the huge numbers that you would expect to essentially draw the attention of voters and get them into the Hall of Fame? So, you know, the fact that somebody with whose credentials were no doubt about it as good as Mike Mussina's, that it took this long, it's going to be very interesting to see in the future how we get to a point where starting pitchers are still getting elected to the Hall of Fame. But thankfully, the voters did the right thing with Mussina. You know, Mariano Rivera, there really isn't much to say. I mean, like, you know, I'll always joke that the thing I always think of when I think of Mariano Rivera is Tony Womack, but that's because I'm not a Yankees fan. But the fact that, you know, like, again, the greatest closer of all time has finally gotten into the Hall of Fame. It was his first time in the ballot. He was unanimous. There really wasn't any debate about whether or not. And frankly, I think the more interesting conversation about, you know, what to do with Mo on the ballot was whether or not he should be unanimous and whether or not voters, because of the process of how you vote for people and every vote is effectively a vote against everybody else on the ballot that you don't vote for, whether or not he should be unanimous when it was going to penalize so many players who also deserve consideration. So, you know, looking at those three, and then the late Roy Halladay, in the case of a first ballot, was, I think, you know, whether or not he deserved to be a first ballot Hall of Famer, I think that conversation is essentially mooted, because I think there is no doubt that at his peak he was a Hall of Fame pitcher, totally belonged in the Hall of Fame. And the question is, if you're going to get hung up on the rigmarole about whether or not people should be elected in the first ballot, to my way of thinking, the real problem there is that why would you make a widow and his children wait for him to be elected to the Hall of Fame? He's a Hall of Famer. It kind of, again, I think gets into the question of process and, you know, like, skip the precedents, skip over, you know, like, whether or not people should be first ballot Hall of Famers versus any other Hall of Famers. We're only talking about Hall of Famers here. So, you know, whether or not, like, you know, this hang up about whether or not people should be voted in on their first year, I was glad, very glad, particularly for the benefit of his family, that, you know, like, Roy Halladay finally got his due.
You know, regarding Roy Halladay, I know that you had just talked about how you didn't want his widow and children to wait, but putting that situation aside, do you truly feel that Halladay's numbers are Hall of Fame worthy? Because you look at guys like Schilling and Mussina. Schilling has yet to get in, Mussina just getting in. And some may argue that they have better numbers, in totals at least, compared to Halladay. It took them that long to get in. So how do you think that compares to Halladay's situation?
Well, I think ultimately they all belong in the Hall of Fame. And I think that that's a question of, again, you know, Mussina, I think people were hung up on what I consider ticky-tack considerations, like, you know, 20 wins in a season or Cy Young Awards or, you know, was he ever on a world championship winner? And these are things that, you know, in the context of Hall of Fame performance, the kind of player who, you know, again, if you wanted to win, you were going to go out and get, as the Yankees did. And so if you wanted, you know, he was a critical component to the good, you know, the previous last good Orioles teams for this last team that has just kind of done a faceplant. But the 90s Orioles teams that, like, kind of, like, were a remarkable rebuild, particularly when they were coming back from, you know, a really bad patch in the late 80s. So Mike Mussina, I just, again, it's, I think it's silly that he wasn't already in, but that doesn't mean that we should then pass along that penalty to Roy Halladay in particular. Curt Schilling, I think you get into other issues about, you know, the way in which Curt has alienated, I think, a significant number of potential voters. And, you know, that's where people get into the question of whether or not did he have a Hall of Fame career and whether or not what he's done with his life since his career is something that, like, you know, might get people, like, all worked up on the character clause. Or, you know, when you say that hanging journalists is, you know, a good idea, you're probably not going to do very well in a journalist poll.
Well, let me ask you this, because now that we're talking about all these different players getting in and talking about the pitching standard being different, what's your personal standard in regards to pitchers getting into the Hall of Fame? What do you look for as a voter when you decide which starting pitcher should be in? I mean, obviously, the old school stats of 300 wins, 3,000 strikeouts, those are kind of going away at this point. So what do you look for as a voter now?
Well, I look at both a combination of, you know, excellence. You know, I really believe, you know, Jaffe's tools are extremely useful as a way of starting the conversation, of balancing career value against peak value. That's where, again, I would say Halladay, whereas some people might say he came up short on the career value because of a relatively short career, because of his peak and because of his importance to, you know, a number of very important teams and very successful teams, you don't win without Roy Halladay. Now, that said, I also tend to be fairly generous in terms of who I think of as people we should be considering for the Hall of Fame. I think it was kind of a travesty that Kevin Brown fell off the ballot so quickly. I'm favorably inclined towards the case of somebody like Andy Pettit, where if I have room on the ballot, I'm going to want to put Andy Pettit in. Because, again, he had a big career, a lot of wins, was a key player on a number of contenders, and has the career numbers. I mean, for those who say, you know, that imagine that the Hall of Fame is only this Valhalla where only 300 game winners or only, you know, the greatest of all, single greatest players of all time, and that it should be a small hall. You know, I go back to, you know, the voters, you know, the people who essentially, like, in the first decade of the Hall of Fame's existence were voting people in. Well, those people, like, long before we get into Veterans Committee considerations and whether or not the hall has been, you know, cheapened by, you know, like, too many people being brought in, before you get into any of that, the voters were voting in people like Herb Pennick. And I'm like, okay, well, Herb Pennick was okay. He's pretty good. But, you know, the guy who's the third or fourth starter on, like, you know, those great Yankees teams of the 20s, I don't know if he's really who you're supposed to put in the Hall of Fame. But obviously, if the people who created the Hall of Fame effectively already think that a number three starter is a pretty good guy to put in the Hall of Fame, then, you know, I think there's already a pretty big hint there that we should be pretty generous about career achievements and people who accumulate good numbers and people who should be in the Hall of Fame. And just because they don't have singular talents or didn't lead, like, all of Major League history in strikeouts or didn't do, you know, win 7 Cy Young Awards, which, you know, is, again, kind of crazy. The Cy Young, Roger Clemens is not in. But, you know, you don't have to be on that summit, but other people get into the Hall of Fame, too. And so that's where I keep coming back to, yeah, we should probably be having a much more reasonable conversation about Kevin Brown, but he's already been eliminated, and that's a little crazy. Andy Pettit, yeah, no, we should be talking a little bit more about Andy Pettit. So I, like I said, I take the generous view. I think I'm a big Hall believer, and I think if we get more people in, then it's going to be good, because fundamentally, I think, you know, the most essential question for me in choosing any Hall of Famer is really whether or not you can tell the history of the game in the period during which that guy played. I think if you can't tell the story without him, then you need to put him in the Hall of Fame. And if you can tell the history of the game without him, then maybe you need to, like, kind of, like, dial it back and think about, like, well, can I really put this guy in the Hall of Fame? And I think that's where, again, I think that ends up being a more generous standard, because there are people you absolutely do want in the conversation, regardless of a career achievement. So, I mean, for me, I think it's inconceivable when we get to the day that David Ortiz is on the ballot, you know, like, his numbers may not add up in terms of pure slugging numbers relative to other sluggers, but how can you not talk about baseball in the oddies and not have David Ortiz in the conversation? You've got to have David Ortiz in the Hall of Fame. He's fundamental to telling baseball history over the last 20 years.
Christina Carl here on Sports Talk Chicago. And Christina, keeping your thoughts in mind about Halladay and what you just told me, who else did you include on your ballot this year? And if you want, just a small rationale of why you included them.
Well, Bonds and Clemens, I voted for both of them. I will always be voting for them as long as they're on the ballot. I can promise you that for the next several years that they're still on the ballot. I'm sorry, but 7 MVP awards, 7 Cy Youngs, they were among the best players I've ever seen in any era ever. It's just, I think, kind of silly not to be voting for them. Question about whether or not how much they owe to steroids, I think, is related to a broader question of Well, you know, the game profited from steroids, and people who profited from steroids and people who managed steroid-using players are in the Hall of Fame. So, you know, I think we need to have a reckoning in terms of acknowledging that that was a that period, the so-called steroids era from the mid-90s to 2006, was an era in which steroid use was rampant. We don't know who used and how much. We just need to kind of put that aside. We recognize that that was part of the game in the same way that I think we have to acknowledge that when you're talking about records set when baseball wasn't integrated, we have to recognize that the audience understands that the game has changed over time. And so that's where, yeah, they use steroids. We know they might have used steroids. We don't know how much they used or what benefit they got, but we know that they probably used some performance-enhancing steroids. And we just have to acknowledge that and move on. We can't talk about the history of the game without them. They need to be in the Hall of Fame. Similarly, I put Sammy Sosa on my ballot, which is definitely might anger some, but I figure is just a recognition that you can't talk about baseball in the 90s and baseball's comeback as an industry from the strike without talking about Sammy Sosa and the role he played in that. I mean, my wife, frankly, she doesn't know much about baseball. She doesn't love baseball. She doesn't follow baseball. But she, when I say Sammy Sosa, she says, 1998. 67, you know, home runs. Yeah, no, I know who Sammy Sosa is. And when somebody who isn't even a fan of the game knows who Sammy Sosa is, isn't that a fundamental measure of fame? It just seems to me strange that we are already trying to bury or forget what Sammy meant to baseball in the late 90s. Gary Sheffield was somebody else who I had on my ballot who, again, I think of as if you were going to contend, if you were going to win in the 90s or into the oddies, Gary Sheffield was a slugger you wanted to get. When you look at his B-War, or offense-only B-War, baseball reference war, when you look at his hitting, his numbers are well above the standard already set by Hall of Fame right fielders. So even if you just look at right fielders, and even if, which is a tough position, a lot of great players, Babe Ruth, you know, on down, if you look at that group alone of those who've already been elected, and if you look at that group, whether you even splice it, say, you know, only since integration or only elected by the writers versus people on the Veterans Committee. However you slice it, the offensive numbers Gary Sheffield has put up are eminently Hall of Fame worthy. They're at or above the regular, like the average for all Hall of Fame right fielders. So the fact that we've already kind of erased Gary Sheffield and he isn't getting much more than 15% of the vote, that to me strikes me as a little crazy. I mean, again, if you followed baseball in the era, Gary Sheffield was somebody you paid attention to. In fact, I think in his most recent, in the most recent Bill James handbook, I want to say Bill James actually wrote that, you know, at that time when he was working, or he's still working with the Red Sox, but his point was that Gary Sheffield was the one batter in the entirety of baseball, that Gary Sheffield was the batter that the Red Sox, on their way to breaking the curse and all that, he was the batter they were most afraid of, most concerned with, most dangerous hitter. So even if you're going to go with the most superficial, like, say, Jim Rice level comparison of saying, like, wow, he's a dangerous and scary hitter. Well, you know what? If you're going to put Jim Rice in the Hall of Fame, then Gary Sheffield is Jim Rice, but better. So, and a lot better, because he's actually above the standard for offensive players in right field. So, again, I think Gary Sheffield's not getting his due. Somebody else who I figure I'm going to be voting for as long as he's on the ballot. My last two choices, Scott Rolen and Larry Walker. Larry Walker is on his next to last year. He's another great right fielder, but more of an all-around player. When you look at his offensive impact, I think how I put it in the write-up that I did on Hall of Fame hitters is that you're talking about a guy who played a great right field and also had the offensive impact of David Ortiz over the course of his career. So you put that together, and yeah, that's a Hall of Fame career. I know people are hung up on the numbers about that he generated hitting in Coors Field, but he was a great example of how you get when you put a plain old great hitter in Coors Field over the course of his career, or over a big chunk of his career, not somebody who could only hit in Coors Field. And so I think that's an important distinction, because when you look at his road numbers over his full time as a player, he was still a Hall of Fame caliber hitter. So that's where I just end up with, yeah, we should be putting Larry Walker in. And then finally, Scott Rolen, third base. It's you know, maybe on the offensive side a bit of a stretch, but third base is historically an underrepresented position in the Hall, not a place where a lot of people get voted into or voted from, and of course a large part of the argument about his value depends on his on how you evaluate his defense. I guess I go back and look at Scott Rolen and also remember that Scott Rolen was critical to the Cardinals winning that championship in 2006. He was the franchise player in the Phillies in the late 90s. For the Cardinals to go out and get Rolen was a huge move for them. And for the Reds, when they were actually rebooting, he was an important addition to them as well. Again, you got Scott Rolen because you wanted to win, and he ended up being a critical component of a number of winning teams. And why? Because he could get on base, he hit for a lot of power, and he was arguably the best defensive third baseman in the league of his era. So, again, I think he deserves more credit than he's gotten. We'll see if he gets his due. Fingers crossed.
Well, let me ask you about this. Now, obviously, you're okay with voting for steroid users. You mentioned Bonds, Clemens, Sosa, and Sheffield. And what I find interesting is that, although you're okay with voting for them, you're not necessarily okay with Pete Rose being eligible, let alone becoming a member of the Hall of Fame. And it seems like, to most voters at least, if you're going to vote for steroid users, you might as well vote for Pete Rose should he become eligible. So my question is, do you feel that betting on the game is worse than performance-enhancing drug use? And if so, why do you think that?
Well, I think betting on a team, or betting for your team or betting against your team, when you're playing for that team or when you're managing that team, and Pete Rose did all of that. He voted, he was betting before he stopped being a manager or stopped being a player, while he was a player manager, and almost certainly while he was a player as well. According to John Dowd, who ran Major League Baseball's investigation of him, he bet against his team as well as for his team. So that canard that Rose has defended himself with when he was moved from lying about his betting on baseball to saying, well, I only bet on my own team. At this point, I think we can safely say Pete Rose has lied about pretty much every element of this. So, you know, whether or not that means that he's using his team to win in different ways as a manager, whether as a player he's got something invested in the outcome beyond winning or losing, I think it's a much, much more dangerous ethical issue for baseball. And I think that, you know, maintaining that standard going back to the year we are a century later of, you know, the 1919 Black Sox, but that standard of saying that there's a bright line between people who bet on baseball should forever be ineligible and should be barred from the game, I stick with that. That still makes sense. That's still, I think, the right place for the industry to be. Pete Rose is still entirely guilty of all of the things that he denied initially and had lied about for years and damaged the game, lying about it for years. And compared to that, steroids is just about guys who want to be better at baseball. And, you know, when you put those two things against, a side by side, it just seems to me crazy that anybody would put Pete Rose on the, you know, say that, well, then Pete Rose isn't guilty of so much. Well, no, these guys just wanted to be better at something they were already great at. I don't really have an issue with that in the sense that all they want to do is win baseball games. All they want to do is score more runs, hit more home runs, strike out more people, be a better player. And since we don't even know the extent to which PEDs have, you know, a definite impact on particular players, I think the safest way to sum it up is results vary. I just don't think it's anything close to the same ethical issue compared to Rose's betrayal of, you know, one of baseball's most fundamental rules, a rule he was entirely aware of when he was breaking it, and then continued to lie about and damage and attack the game afterwards when he was still denying it.
You know, you mentioned steroid users and the effects in which certain guys have or haven't used it. We don't know during that era. As a Hall of Fame voter, do you think that right now there are steroid users in the Hall of Fame?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think that that's even really up for debate. People who have either used, I mean, whether you want to say steroids specifically or specific steroids versus PEDs in general, again, I think we're pretty well aware that, you know, some players used various substances at different points of their career. That's without getting into, you know, the broader assumption that almost everybody who played baseball from the 60s on were using amphetamines. I think, you know, there was already the accusation, and I think this goes back to the spring campaign against a number of players who probably use steroids in the 70s, because I think it's kind of naive, effectively, to decide that baseball only discovered steroids when Jose Canseco made it to the major leagues in 1986. I mean, or made it to stay in 86 and had a cup of coffee in 85. But my point being that, like, look, when you saw steroid use was rampant in the NFL in the 70s and was particularly, you know, like, I think there was a great piece on ESPN a couple of years back about, like, one particular trainer's introduction of steroids into the AFL Chargers in the late 60s. I mean, the use of steroids was something that was known in sports well before Jose Canseco or any, well before the quote-unquote steroids era of the 90s. And so the extent to which people were using and getting away with it in the 70s, I think, and perhaps even the 60s, I don't think we even know to what extent. And I don't know, you know, given baseball's punitive approach to the challenge of steroids, I don't know if we're ever going to know to what extent people were using. I know that there are plenty of players. I think Tom House is a good example of somebody who said, like, look, if I thought it would make me better and I had known about it, I would have used it. Players are going to use. We have examples of whether it's Babe Ruth or even a player in the 19th century. I mean, people shooting up all sorts of things, like just trying to get better at baseball. And so I think, you know, if baseball had chosen something different from the Mitchell report and using PEDs and punishment for PED use as a brickbat to go after the union, you know, I think if baseball had not adopted that and had instead treated it as a opportunity to have people come clean and kind of pursue what I would consider more of a truth and reconciliation process where people came clean, there would be an amnesty where everybody talks about what happened, what they did, and then, you know, subsequently comes up with a joint agreement where nobody is going to use, and so invest, get the players invested in that kind of approach as well, instead of, as the Mitchell report kind of reflected, this approach of trying to punish the players, hurt them financially, and get them. Again, I think that this is kind of an artifact related to baseball's, like, decades-long labor war, and something that, you know, unfortunately in this case, really leaves us with more questions than answers.
I wanted to now shift to the game today. It's been reported that Major League Baseball is considering a number of rule changes to implement in the near future, including a universal DH, relief pitcher minimum, pitch clock, and roster expansion. First, I want to get your impressions on all these proposed changes. How do you think they're going to change the game for the better or the worse?
I like almost all of them. I mean, I know I'm supposed to be getting to an age where I'm supposed to be an old-timer and against change or whatever. No, I love the idea of the universal DH. I am cool with the idea of expanding rosters by one if it, like, as long as there's a cutoff on pitchers that, like, we don't have 13 or 14 pitchers on a roster. I want to see a 14-12 split. I want to see people go back to having offensive tactics used in-game instead of, like, the relatively static lineups and pretty much benchless rosters that we've had to see in the last several years. I like the idea. I mean, I've written in the past, I mean, several years ago, I said I thought that we should move to a standard where relievers have to, you know, face a minimum of three batters. And even then, I mean, disagreeing with some of my colleagues, they said, well, that's too many or too high. And it's always like, you know, or that wouldn't have the right effect. I think three batters is a reasonable standard. Maybe it's because baseball is a game of threes, whether it's three times three is nine innings, or three batters, three outs, three balls, three strikes. I mean, three makes sense for me, both, like, for those kind of sentimental reasons, but I also think in terms of the challenge to the pitcher themselves. And, yeah, it's probably going to end the career of some extreme situational lefty-type pitchers, but if that, what we gain from that is better, more rounded pitchers as a population, and as we get more pinch hitters or more people, more offensive strategy like pinch running, I take that trade-off in a heartbeat. I mean, I do not think I'm going to miss the situational lefty and the abbreviation, you know, the way in which bringing a guy like that into the game to face one batter So you stop the action. You have that guy who'll throw his warm-up pitches. Then he retires his one batter. Then he leaves. I mean, this goes back to, you know, the anti-climax. Maybe it's just one of my memories from way back when. But I remember watching Greg Catterays in, like, Major League debut in 1987, taking my baby brother to his first ball game. And he came in, and he walked Wade Boggs on four pitches, and he came out. And it's like, I don't think Greg Catterays remembers that moment or wants to remember that moment in particular. But looking at it, it's like, okay, that's just – and, of course, it was Tony La Russa managing the A's in that game. But and it's just – that's just lame, and it's not – interesting, and it's bad for action. It's bad for infield play. Unless somebody needs to take a long bathroom break, or go run and get a beer or a hot dog, you know, like, what's the point? It's an adaptation that the game has taken to an extreme that I think, you know, doesn't even pay off as much as they like to claim, and I think it's just not a good adaptation. I think it's the game has kind of taken itself into an adaptive cul-de-sac that doesn't really help the industry and doesn't really help baseball as an entertainment product.
After what you said, what's your response to the baseball purist viewpoint, people who reject some of these changes? I mean, for example, the DH wasn't created until 1973. There was lots of backlash at the time. And a pitch clock today would end the hallmark of this game, the fact that there's no time limit and no clock to race against. So what would you say to those who have that purist viewpoint and don't want necessarily all of these changes that are being proposed?
Well, I think I would sentence anybody who's against a pitch clock to watching Pedro Baez highlights forever. if you want a guy who's just going to sit out there and dawdle, I mean, it was amusing. Okay, maybe this is, again, more timely. But he was a starting pitcher who was an infamous dawdler on the mound. Steve Traxel would just basically be standing out there all afternoon, and you know, you wouldn't even necessarily know he was at a ball game because he was just staring at the sky and at the ball in his hand and waddling around and thinking some more and shaking him off and then stepping off the rubber and then thinking some more. And it was interminable. And I'm sorry, I mean, as a standard, like 20-second pitch, I think the pitch clock is a good idea. And it depends, of course, on the extent to which it's enforced. And again, we've seen that umpires can be pretty lenient when it comes to the subject of enforcement, whether it's about getting batters to step in. Every time they're encouraged to maintain pace of play by making sure that batters step in a more timely fashion, you know, which again, I think is a good idea, but they kind of end up getting lax on that. I don't think we've seen, it's not quite as silly as like what we saw with like, say, Craig Biggio or Nomar Garciaparra. I mean, Craig Biggio would be like, you know, fixing all of the armor he was wearing, like on his lead arm, like in between every pitch, or Pedro or Nomar Garciaparra doing his elaborate routine between every at bat, or, you know, but I don't think those are necessarily interesting or useful. And frankly, you know, just again, it's an entertainment product. If, you know, you want people standing around all day, well, go watch cricket. I mean, frankly, I'm sorry. I mean, baseball is not just about the tension of waiting for action. You also got to pick things up a little bit. And so I think of, to any purist who's going to complain about like what these kinds of things do, I'm going to sit there and say, well, then go back and look at footage of baseball from like the 60s or 70s. Go back and look at base footage of how the pace of play in those games, because yeah, you don't have people stepping out, you don't have people dawdling on the mound, you don't have, so if you think you're a purist, well then let's bring it back to that. And if it requires a pitch clock to get us back to that, then I think obviously it's a good thing, because again, it picks up the pace of play, and I'd rather have that than, you know, this kind of what I think of as like exaggerated concern over tradition, when I think what people might perceive as tradition isn't even traditional.
Moving now to your personal career, I'd like to hear about your journey in sports media. I mean, I'd mentioned that you had co-founded Baseball Prospectus. Now you're the senior MLB editor at ESPN. How'd you become such a successful figure in sports media today, and how did your journey start versus where it finished right now?
Well, I think I was in the right place at the right time. I think being essentially a kid goofing off on the internet in the mid-90s, and having a lot to say on the subject of sports was very much a case of being in the right place at the right time. And so right after the strike in 94 and baseball coming, like, I think that also kind of was an interesting development because a lot of people left sports writing and a lot of people, like, this was right after the National, the Daily Sports Magazine had collapsed. There was an understanding that there was a larger audience for sports than was being served by daily newspapers, and I think that creating a specialized product, both online and in print at that time, was something that people wanted. And so, like, I think mostly, I think for those of us, the five of us who co-founded Baseball Prospectus, a lot of it was about creating the kind of content we wanted to read because people weren't serving that need. And so, and anticipating that there would be a lot of people like us who wanted to read this stuff and wanted to and had things to say. And so growing from that into and essentially challenging what I would say the mainstream and starting out very much as an outsider, but almost immediately gaining credibility because of our research, because of our work, gaining research or gaining credibility for people on the inside in baseball, this at a time where sabermetrics had not yet been broadly embraced by people on the inside of the industry. And so having people who are ready to accept or listen or understand and then think about how they could integrate that approach into how they've built their teams. I mean, we figured out we were onto something pretty quickly when some of our first, you know, hardhead, like, you know, serious analysts like Keith Woolner got hired out from under us by major league teams. So that's where we learned that, you know, Baseball Prospectus was not just about creating content, it was also, you know, quickly becoming an industry thought leader, and so, which created opportunities that were unexpected for a lot of our personnel. And so, you know, the way I always thought of Baseball Prospectus, it has been a launching pad for people to take their careers in what direction they wanted to go. If you were a serious analyst and you wanted to essentially show your work at Baseball Prospectus to effectively audition for an analytics job in a major league front office, well, you could do that. If you wanted to work in scouting and player development and show your chops on that front side of the game, you could do that and also get hired by a team. If you were a columnist and extremely opinionated and had a lot of interesting things to say and, you know, could really write, again, that's where I think, you know, whether it's people like Jonah Carey or Joe Sheehan or Jay Jaffe or Randy Gisarelli or myself, you know, like, you know, we all got started at Baseball Prospectus. We all graduated to bigger things. And in a sense, because we went through a testing ground where people paid attention to what we had to say and what we had to do. So that was an extreme treat, but it was also an opportunity for me as an editor to work with a lot of young writers just starting out and help them with their game, as it were, and also really learn a lot about the writer-editor relationship. So the interesting thing for me in that was that first it, of course, created an opportunity to then work at Brassy Sports and launch, like, a list of titles where, again, I got to help spread, I think, the sabermetric message to a number of writers in a number of industries. I mean, I published John Hollinger's first book on basketball analytics. I published Dean Oliver's first book on basketball analytics. I helped get, Aaron Schatz from Football Outsiders. I think I published his first, like, essential, like, essays and papers, like, in a pro football annual. And so, you know, I got exposure to and learned a lot about analytics and other sports, and essentially created the same opportunities for people that I had helped create for myself in baseball. And so that was definitely a treat and something I'm, in retrospect, pretty proud of. But all of that led to eventually drawing the attention of ESPN because they had hired enough of our writers away from us over time that eventually when the editor who was running ESPN's baseball effort at that time, Dave Kuhl, rang me up and asked, well, you know, we've hired a bunch of your people over the years, and we were wondering, were you ever going to be available? And that's the kind of phone call you take. and you think about. And, you know, even if at that point I had been with Baseball Prospectus for 15 years, you know, ultimately I had to say yes. I mean, I wanted the opportunity to come and work on baseball content for ESPN. And so that was both a remarkable privilege, but something also that, you know, effectively I had earned through long decades of work. And, you know, as much as I joke that I'm the accidental sports writer, because after all, at that time, when I first got started with Baseball Prospectus back in 1996, I was a graduate student in history with a day job in archaeology publishing at the Oriental Institute. You know, that's not necessarily the background of your normal sports writer, but as it's worked out, you know, I've turned my passion into my career and been able to enjoy it far more than I think I ever really expected. When I applied for the Baseball Writers Association the first time back in 2008, you know, I didn't expect that they would say yes. At that point, no internet-based writers were members of the BBWAA. Everybody was part of a print publication, a news daily, or a major magazine. And so, you know, the fact that internet writers hadn't even been brought in, let alone a trans woman, you know, for me, I thought, you know, like, well, we'll give it a shot because I do want to get back in the locker room. I do want to do reporting, and I do want to do, you know, stories. I want to tell stories talking to players and managers and really get into some of the stuff that you can't just do flying a spreadsheet or looking at history or trends. And they said yes. And to their credit and to my great benefit, I mean, that guarantee of access, you know, something that I really enjoyed using. I've enjoyed, like, being able to do features with players and managers and general managers, and found the game enormously responsive and receptive. And, again, if you had asked me in 1995, was any of that possible, you know, before, as we were just starting up Baseball Prospectus, I would have said no. I can't imagine all of that would happen. But the fact that we've gotten to this point, and that, you know, kind of to take us full circle in this conversation, the fact that now I have a Hall of Fame vote, you know, it's just proof that you never know where you're going to wind up until you try.
And Christina, before we let you go today, I wanted to ask you about Keith Olbermann's attack on you on Twitter when you released your Hall of Fame ballot. Have you forgiven him for what he said?
No, Keith, I mean, again, I love Keith. Keith has written a foreword for Baseball Prospectus in the past. I understand Keith feels very strongly, but that's one of the great things about sports, is that you can have passionate disagreements that don't end with, well, and I hate everything you stand for. Keith and I fundamentally disagree about some things about the Hall of Fame. That doesn't mean I hate Keith Olbermann. It means I think Keith has a strong opinion, and God bless him for it.
Well, Christina, thank you so much for being here on the show. It was such a pleasure to have you on today.
Oh, I am flattered, and sounds like you're doing some great things with the podcast, so I'll be looking forward to future episodes myself.
Thank you. What an honor it was to have Christina Carl on today's show as we talk with her about her MLB Hall of Fame ballot, some proposed baseball rule changes, and, of course, her amazing journalism career. And for someone in Christina who lived here in Chicago for many years, she went to the University of Chicago and Loyola University, it's really nice to have that hometown Chicago connection on this podcast. And secondly, I truly enjoyed our in-depth, hard-hitting baseball conversation. And it's funny because when I originally reached out to Christina to invite her here on the podcast, she told me in her response that this should be no holds barred. She told me that I can steer the interview in whichever way I wanted to, and that she'd be willing and open to answering every question. And I feel that her opinions, her insights, her logic all contributed to a very entertaining and memorable podcast. Well, that does it for us here at Sports Talk Chicago. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at @ChiTalkSports and hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram at John Zags, on Twitter at John Z Sports, and now on Facebook at John Zaglua. Also, make sure to subscribe to the website. You can find the subscription box on the homepage of the site. Simply type in your email, click yes on the confirmation email, and from there, you'll be subscribed. You'll receive every new podcast and article directly to your email. And remember, Sports Talk Chicago is now on iTunes and Google Play. Simply search Sports Talk Chicago, and every podcast from the 2018-19 calendar year is now available. Feel free to leave us a 5-star rating and or write a review. Your support is greatly appreciated. And finally, if you enjoy today's podcast, tune in to my new radio show every Monday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. on 88.5 WHPK-FM Chicago. You'll still hear my same hard-hitting Chicago sports opinions. Plus, we'll add special segments and, of course, very special guests on each show. Again, that's every Monday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. on 88.5 WHPK-FM Chicago. Thank you again for listening in to today's show, and have a great day.